This is the Open Air Project.
If you want to do something, get out and do it.
And do it now. Do it while you can.
Life is just too short.
So I want to talk real quick. We have a camp. I have a camp. And some things that I wanted to, you know, you think a camp is a good idea, right? Everybody thinks it's a great idea. And
for the most part, they are.
Well, they are. I agree. But there are issues with camps. You know, some people call them cabins. They're hunting camps, whatever they are. The problem is that if you don't have enough time to use it, then it just becomes a money problem.
Or, well, it's basically like not on the same scale, but it's like taking care of another house.
It is. You're right. You have to go and you have to mow. You have to go and...
There's always maintenance needed.
Right. So this week we have Garrett Prawl. Is it Prawl?
Yeah.
We have Garrett Prawl on the line with us. Garrett is the DIY sportsman. He has a YouTube channel and he has a webpage, and I'll give that out here later. Garrett, do you have a camp?
Sort of. The only real camp that I have is when I go up to my buddies around Duluth, and I basically just sleep up in his attic. And I usually do that around the rut, you know, usually every year, but that's about the closest thing to a deer camp that I have.
So I'm out at camp right now. And I'm not there right now, obviously, but I have a project going on out at camp right now, and it is I'm drywalling a back room, and so I'm doing this because my wife, and she'll be listening to this, but my wife and I decided that, you know, we don't use it enough, and maybe we should sell it. So get out there, I'm starting to drywall it, and my buddy here, Steve, all of a sudden is like, you know, this is going to look really good, and you're really going to want to hang out here whenever it's done.
I'm not trying to talk you into anything. I'm just, I guess I don't want you to be sorry later.
Well, it's possible.
That might happen, yeah. I'm not trying to persuade you one way or the other. You need to do what is right for you, and...
Well,
I don't have one, so I can't say on... I mean, I've spent time at yours, and my grandparents had one, and it's still there. My uncle lives there, but it's still... We still use it as a hunting camp. He just... he's retired, and he lives there now, so...
Well, you know, it was great whenever I was hanging out there all the time, but lately, I just don't have the time for it. I mean... Unfortunately, I can't get out there enough to make it worth it. That may change, but and nothing is set in stone yet. So
two sides, you're gonna fight that in your head until you do one or the other, and then whatever you do isn't gonna be right. So
I know.
Just do what your wife wants to do, and then you'll have to live with it either way. Right?
I will. She isn't pushing one way or the other than the fact that, look, if you're going to keep it, you got to use it. And I'm just not using it enough right now. We hunt in this area anyway, so we don't have to go somewhere to hunt.
Well, and to use that for most of our hunting, it would be traveling farther than we normally would. To travel from home if we were doing it, right?
To travel from my camp.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. But there's plenty of ground out there to hunt, too.
There is.
But at any rate, it's a conundrum. I'm tossing it up right now in the air, and, you know, it wouldn't, you know, if I took that money, and my daughter's going to college next year, so... You know, I could use it for that, but anyways.
You can never get your camp back.
That's the problem, right? Yeah. That's the whole problem. So, Garrett, welcome to the show. we're glad to have you on here.
The DIY sportsman, he's doing some awesome stuff. Those YouTube videos are, I told you a couple years ago that I was watching that stuff. Some of the tree stand hacks that this guy has is pretty cool.
Garrett, why don't you give us a little bit of background about yourself real quick? You know, how did you get into hunting?
Yeah, it's so basically my dad got me into hunting, and he wasn't really that into it himself. He just kind of got into it again, kind of when I was around that 11, 12 year old age, just to kind of introduce me and get me into it. And then I started getting into it a lot more. And now we're at the point where I'm, you know, pretty obsessed about it. And he doesn't really hunt anymore. He's more into the fishing side of things now. So I probably in my mid teens, high school age, I, you know, bought a camera, started filming my hunts, and then just kind of grew from there. Started making videos on, you know, the tree stand hacks, like you said, and other DIY type videos.
So you, let me get this right. You started filming right off the bat.
Yeah, probably about, I think when I was 15 was when I first started bringing a camera into the woods.
Wow.
What brought that decision on? Was it because of the hunting shows you were watching, or was it just something that...
No, I think it was about at that time was when I was first starting to get into the hunting forums online too.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, like small groups of guys that were starting to get into it and share their footage with one another. And I thought it'd be cool to do and, you know, at the very least be able to kind of see where my shot placement is and that type of thing. Kind of the practical application of it.
So when you first started hunting, Garrett, was it archery only, or did you get into rifle right away too?
I did both. Actually, yeah. I started with firearms first. Shot my first year with a shotgun, 12 gauge, and then it wasn't until I was 14 that I actually shot my first year with a bow.
Mm. You're in Wisconsin, is that correct?
I think Minneapolis. Yeah,
right. Minneapolis. No, I grew up in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, speaking of me, so let's, I want to talk about that real quick. You guys in Minnesota, your rifle or your gun season comes in right during the rut. Is that right?
Yep.
Oh man.
Right smack during the middle of the rut.
That's killer.
That is crazy.
So do you see, I mean, I'm sure you hunted in Wisconsin then, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you see the deer moving differently in Minnesota because of that?
A little bit sometimes. And what I've actually started doing is I try to get around that by either hunting in bow only areas or just hunting in Wisconsin during the rut.
Because
it's kind of a weird mix, because you'll get some of that normal firearms pressure deer movement just from the people walking around.
Yeah.
But then you also get the normal deer movement from the rut. So it's a strange mix. And some people, obviously the core of firearm hunters in Minnesota is fine with it. They've obviously enjoy it, and there's a lot of guys that do both, like me. I hunt with bow and firearm still, but it's just, yeah, it's different. You got to get used to it.
Do you know what the diehard bow hunters think of that? Does that cause a conflict?
Yeah, it does a little bit. If you go on a lot of the Minnesota hunting forums, they'll have arguments about it every year.
I would think so. That's the first thing I thought of when that was brought up here. I would think that. Now, you said something about bow hunter specific areas. Is that something that the public, is that on public ground?
There's some public areas that are archery only, and then there's also some metro hunts that are archery only.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be a pretty good conflict of interest if guys were just strictly bow hunters, and all of a sudden now you open up a gun season right when all the great bow hunting's about to start. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the other thing too is you can only shoot one buck combined throughout all your seasons in Minnesota.
Yeah.
So if you're bow hunting throughout September and October, and then you buy a rifle tag and you shoot a buck with your rifle, your tag for archery is filled.
Yeah.
You know, for that buck. So you'd have to go to a different state or, so that's usually what I end up doing, is that's why I go to Wisconsin a lot during the rut.
Yeah. That's how our state is too. One buck, whether you get it in archery or rifle, because our bow season comes back in after Christmas then. But if you've used that tag for rifle season, you can't use it again.
That's it.
Right. Yeah.
So what, so you got into filming hunts, and then you start doing these DIY videos. The one I was looking at today is insane. I think you're climbing a tree without a stick at all. Do you use that method, like when you're hunting?
No.
Okay.
Not really.
It was just something you wanted to show.
There's kind of a weird hierarchy of climbing methods, where on one end of the spectrum, you can have something that's really lightweight, which obviously gives you a huge advantage if you're walking in a long ways, mm-hmm. but it can be really hard to use. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you got stuff that's, you know, like a ladder stand, for instance, really easy to use, but weighs a ton.
Yeah.
So I usually end up somewhere in the middle of that spectrum.
Some of those early ones where you modified like some of the sticks and you used tubing and built, I actually used that one. That's one of the ones that early on that I was talking about, to put another step on the bottom of your stick.
Yep.
That actually works fairly well, and you can gain 3-4 feet from the ground. And
Steve, do you use that now?
I have, yeah.
Have you?
Not all the time.
Oh, that's because you're only carrying 3 sticks.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But it works. But that stuff there, those tree stand mods and stuff, and the, you know, the stick mods and some of the climbing videos, that was some of your early stuff, right? That's been a while.
Yeah. That's all pretty much earlier stuff, and some of the things I'm still kind of tweaking and working on. I just built a set of climbing sticks in my garage that I'm going to be making a video on pretty soon.
Oh, really? So
yeah.
That's cool. Do you want to share a little bit about that at all, or do you want to wait and let that come out?
Sure. No, I can talk about it now. It's a pretty simple build. I basically just took 6061 aluminum tubing,
yep.
1 inch. But whereas most sticks on the market will use, you know, roughly a 1/8 inch wall thickness, I got 1/16 wall, just because, you know, kind of the thought process was, well, I'm not 300 pounds.
Yeah.
I'm much less than that. So if a climbing stick commercially made is designed such that, you know, 90% of the population will be able to use it just fine, it's probably not going to be optimal for me. So right. I basically went down to as thin as I could with a really cheap, you know, hardware store grade of aluminum, like the architectural grade stuff, and just kind of saw where the stick would fail.
Right.
And then beefed it back up to the 6061, which is a lot stronger. And then just kind of made the design refinements. And then I have a CNC router in my garage now that I use to design wow. and cut out the double steps to use on it.
Oh, that's cool.
Go ahead. That not only, I guess we should, first off, I want to back up a little bit. What, for you, what prompted these DIY videos? What in your mind said, I want to show everybody what I'm doing? Was it something that you have always done, is like built your own equipment and your own stuff? Because you're not only into like those sticks we just talked about, you've built stabilizers for your bow, you've built
arrow spinners.
Yeah, and your own recurve bows. There's a whole list of stuff that you've done, but
I guess what he's saying is we're impressed.
Yeah, we are for sure. But I want to know what, you know, when did you decide to start showing everybody what you were doing, and how did the DIY sportsman start with his, you know, the YouTube videos and all that?
So, I mean, basically I'd always kind of been like that. I've always kind of built stuff on my own. I remember even as a kid, I was taking, you know, little blocks of like balsa wood and taking a pocket knife, trying to carve out like fishing lures, that type of thing.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until, you know, after I started filming that I started making the videos. And even before that, just on the online forums, just about every hunting forum has a DIY section. And I would always be in those forums reading what other guys have done, making modifications of my own, making threads on various builds. And so it was just kind of a natural progression to start making videos instead of just posting on, you know, one particular forum.
Yeah. So I look at your stuff, I look at guys' stuff on the forums also, and I incorporate that into my system too, because you're never quite getting exactly what you want.
No, and what's neat about it is you still see something from those guys or from Garrett, and you'll say, I never thought of that, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really cool and it works really well, you know? That's what's cool about it.
And it cuts your learning curve down too. I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I guess whenever I was watching you climb without that, without a stick at all, I was thinking, man, you know, that's pretty cool. That's pretty crazy. I probably wouldn't do that. So when you get up there, then you're hanging like you're in a saddle though, right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, you'd still want to use a platform of some type just to keep all the weight off your hips and be able to move around. But yeah.
So let's,
the biggest downside to something like that is that if you ever do need to climb back down for whatever reason, you know, you drop something out of your stand and you don't have a pull rope to pick it up, you got to climb back down and climb back up, and that takes a long time versus sticks where you can just climb back down.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite modification, a favorite build that you've done or anything like that? You know, something that just maybe it was your own and it works so well. Do you have anything in particular?
There's been a few bow holders I made that have worked pretty well. Mm-hmm. The trail camera bracket that I use works extremely well.
Yeah.
That one's pretty cheap. That one's less than $5 to put together. And then the climbing sticks I was talking about, I've been very happy with those so far, just playing around with them in the woods in the backyard.
Those sticks, when you made them, are they have the double steps, like maybe like a muddy stick, or are they staggered like maybe a lone wolf?
They're double like a muddy, except the difference is that instead of being geared, they're just fixed length. So
you can't
fold them up.
Yeah.
But the way I stack them on my saddle platform, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't get in the way at all.
No.
You know, something I had always thought, well, actually, Steve and I have talked about this. He loves his muddies because of the double.
Yeah, I would never give them up for that reason.
It is nice. I've used Lone Wolf all my life. And they're good sticks.
Yeah.
But once I started using the double, yeah, it's nicer.
Yeah.
No, but I wanted to ask you guys, what if you just have a double on the top? Because that's typically the only place you need it, right?
Some guys do that and just modify the top step and are happy with it. The only time that I kind of find myself wanting double steps further down is if I need to climb back up or down, or if it's a really goofy tree that has some weird knobs and crooks in it, then I might put a climbing stick on one side of the tree and then I put the next climbing stick on the other side of the tree, and just where I angle my steps, it ends up getting kind of awkward and I'll end up needing to kind of switch feet and do a little jump.
For me, I don't like having to think about where I need to step, because those lone wolves sometimes start them out, and then you go up to your next stick, and it might not be turned right, so you got to kick it over to the other side, you know, depending on how you go up there. And then a lot of times when we're in Ohio, we're corkscrewing. I corkscrew those things up through there. I just don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I look down. There's a step there. I put my foot on it.
Steve climbed in my tree last year and just absolutely hated my whole setup. but I think it's just whatever you get used to.
That's what it boils down to.
Yeah.
So. I'm sure a few times in and out of years I'd be used to it, but it's just all what you... I mean, for me, I'll never give those double steps up. And I actually went and was going to buy another set of those Muddy Arrow lights, and completely everybody across the country sold out of them. So that says something about, you know, for me, that double step and the way they made those.
So, Garrett, have you thought about taking any of this to production?
Yeah, I've considered it.
Yeah.
I mean, the biggest thing for me, obviously, is, I mean, the startup costs are big. And I think the main thing for me is I try and look at it the same way that, like, you know, capital venturists would look at it. Would I put my money into this if I had, you know, $100,000 to drop into it?
Right.
And what could potentially go wrong? What kind of competition is there? All that kind of stuff. And I think the only time that I would actually make the plunge is if I knew I was onto something really good, not something that's just kind of like nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Well, did you ever consider I mean, you're on, obviously you're on to something. There's all kinds of people watching those videos, and now you're doing sticks. And I mean, obviously that set of sticks price range. Where do you put that with a commercial set? I mean, how much money do you save yourself there?
The 6160 alone is more expensive. Is that right, Garrett?
Well, I imagine that's probably what they use in commercial sticks.
Yeah,
it's a pretty popular used aluminum. There's a different alloy, 7075, that's a lot stronger yet. It's about as strong as some mild steel, but that's about three times as much even as 6061, at least when I've gotten it priced out. But I mean, just in terms of material cost to build my sticks, I think I put in like, oh gosh, I think it was $20 or less per stick. So it was less money for me to buy the materials and build the sticks than it would be for me to buy commercial sticks. But at the same time, I put a lot of time into them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're also getting what you want.
Right. And that was the biggest thing for me. It wasn't necessarily that I wanted to build something to, you know, save money or build something that's better on the market, but more or less build something that was optimized to me and my needs.
That's basically with everything you're doing, though, right? Your stabilizers were the same way. I watched that video a while back, and that was interesting, too.
Yeah, you're doing some really cool stuff, man. It's really interesting. Very innovative. I don't imagine you're an engineer, are you?
I actually am.
Uh-huh. That's what I figured. yeah. So, you know, that's the thinker in you, wanting to always improve, always move on.
What's cool about it is he's not just hunting. He's taking everything to the next level. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's completely what he wants. He's building what he wants. He's modifying what he needs to modify, and it's cool.
Yeah. So now you also have a series on your website about filming, how to film hunts, and I'm just now getting into that. As a matter of fact, I haven't filmed a hunt yet, but I've got my equipment ready for this year. I'm actually excited and a little nervous all at the same time. How many times has filming cost you a hunt?
It's been a handful of times. I'd say probably more often is I'll get into a situation where I'm forced between trying to get the shot on film and shoot the deer, and I've chosen to shoot the deer instead of get the shot on film.
Yeah, that sounds like what I would do.
That's happened a lot.
That's what I would do too, I think.
Well, it's tough. He started early, but we bring a whole different... now you've got so much else to worry about. Is the camera pointed in the right direction? Am I going to put him in the shot? There's just so much... Is he going to see that camera movement? It's for me, I think it's tough. It's something that we never really have thought about until just lately, and now we're going to try and do. But
yeah,
we definitely need a few tips.
Do you have any advice for noobs?
Get comfortable with your equipment. Figure out how to use it at home before you get out in the woods. If you have trees in your backyard, just work on that whole setup of putting up your stand, putting up your camera arm, attaching the camera, you know, turning it on, setting the white balance if you're going to do that, setting the micro levels if you're going to do that, and just take some practice, you know, some practice filming shots. It's probably the best way to do it. It takes some work, but it also just takes kind of the commitment. It's kind of the biggest thing to actually follow through and do what you plan on doing.
Right. Yeah, the discipline, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I picked up a couple really good tips from you, as far as the filming end goes. The belt buckle instead of a ratchet, or the boat buckle instead of a ratchet strap.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I would not want to be in a tree trying to ratchet a camera down, because the way we hunt, we get too close to the deer.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, that ratchet strap's pretty noisy. We typically try to set up everything dead silent, and then it seemed it would seem pointless to go up there and ratchet a camera arm on there. You can, we tried it the other day, you can be quiet, but it still makes noise no matter how careful you try to be with that ratchet.
And that ratchet's so big and clunky, though. I mean, you're bound to knock it off something. Even if you have it covered with steel strips, you're bound to knock it on something and make some noise, I would think.
Yeah.
So
that, yeah, that little lower center buckle is nice. It's real small, compact, minimalist, and it's quiet. It's tough to beat. It's expensive is the only kind of downside to it.
Yeah, but certainly worth it.
Right.
And the other thing was, and I'm going to point this out right now, Fourth Arrow is not sponsoring this show, but that... So I was trying to decide on a camera arm, and I ended up going with that one, and I'm happy with my decision so far. So after, how long have you been filming with that arm?
It's been over a year now.
Yeah, and what do you still think it's right up there with the better arms?
Yeah, I mean, I've never tried their Stiff Arm Pro, kind of their high-end heavy camera version of it, but just using the carbon arm and the normal aluminum one, it's really tough to beat the adjustment of it, just how fast it goes up and how easily I can set it. Because I've had a couple other arms in the past where you set your vertical and your horizontal adjustment separately.
Right.
And that shoulder just makes it so much faster and more effortless.
Yeah.
The only thing that you could say, you know, if you compared that camera arm to something that was more professional grade from another brand, you could put a 6-pound camera on there and be like, oh, well, the Fourth Arrow one is not quite as solid.
Right.
But those cheaper arms are, the lower end arms that they sell are not made for those heavy cameras. They're made for, you know, consumer level cameras and the professional stuff. They got a separate arm for that. So you got to make sure it's an apples to apples comparison.
Sure. What kind of camera are you using?
Right now I have a Sony FDR AX100.
Oh, that's...
Which is, yeah, it's a 4K camera. I usually end up running it now in 4K when I'm self-filming with it too.
I think that's just... I have a 53 instead of the 100. So I'm just a step down from where you're at. Yep.
Well, what your camera has that is nice is it's got that Boss image stabilization.
Oh, yeah.
Which, that's nice. I know a friend that has that camera and it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and trust me, I need that whenever I'm using it, because I'm shaky, you know. But it is nice, and I don't foresee any issues with that camera. I'm holding that camera for sure.
Oh, definitely not.
Right.
What do you use in the tree pointed at yourself then, the actual hunter? What kind of?
I've got a couple. Got a couple different action cams. I got a Sony. Oh gosh. Can't think of what the comparable one now is. I think the X1000 that they have. I got a Polaroid Cube Plus that I also use, and I have a Tacticam, so I kind of can swap between those cameras.
Yeah,
I have a Contour Roam as well, but that one's getting pretty dated.
How many of those do you set? Normally just one, or do you set multiple
angles? My most common setup is just one.
Just one.
Yeah, the overhead view.
Yeah.
Any full-length movies in the future?
I've been contemplating it.
Yeah.
So it's definitely not out of the question, but I don't have any hard plans for one right now.
I watched your 2015 elk trip to Colorado. We had a buddy on last week who's going to... Is he going to Colorado?
Yeah.
He's going to Colorado also for the rut. And he's pretty pumped. I'm extremely jealous. I'd like to get out there and do that. How did you do your research on that?
It was a pretty lengthy process, but I basically just took a map of all the over-the-counter units and had kind of taken the information that we got from going out to, I think it was, went to the Flat Tops area the first time we ever went out there for rifle, and that was just kind of based on, you know, a buddy knows a buddy that, you know, had success in this area. Right. And then the next time we went back with archery, we did a little bit more research I think we called, there's a website called Start My Hunt. We got some maps from that guy where he basically just highlighted some of the, the hotspot type areas, the type of things to look for on a topo map.
Right.
Because we obviously always had, Cal Topo and other websites and Onyx and all that kind of stuff where we were looking at the maps. So we basically just picked an area that had relatively decent success rate for archery over the counter. And then ease of getting to it wasn't a big deal. And we also wanted to go to a wilderness place. So if you kind of took all those parameters, it whittled it down pretty fast.
So when you went into that, I mean, I know me personally, that's a big time hunt, right? So you're putting some time and some money into that. And back to the whole filming thing, would you have let that get in the way at all? The filming aspect of it?
I mean, if it would have came down to me getting the shot on film or shooting an elk, I would have shot the elk. No question.
Yeah.
I'm not about to burn a $600 tag for, to get a shot on film.
Is that what it was? 600?
Yeah, 615, I think it was. Whew. This year I'm going back out there again, but I just got a mule deer tag, which I think is like 380.
So,
that's okay though.
That's interesting too. Yeah. I'd be up for a mule deer hunt.
Cheaper to shoot a mule deer in Colorado than it is to shoot a whitetail in Iowa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you can get some nice muleys out there from what I understand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever drawn an Iowa tag for whitetail?
No, I've never applied. I've gotten really close a couple times and I just keep coming back to, well, there's so much else I could do with that money, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas I have whitetails galore in Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Really hard to take the plunge.
We're kind of in the same boat. We've looked at Iowa. We've looked at some other ones.
That's just so far for us. When we're hunting a piece of ground in southern Ohio that they're not producing
6.5 hours away from us or whatever it is.
They're producing some great whitetails there. I don't understand why we would need to travel other than it's the whole,
Iowa thing.
Yeah. That's everybody's whitetail dream hunt seems to be Iowa. And
well, hey, you heard the guys last week from Midwest Whitetail. There's a lot less pressure there.
That's one of the big draws, yeah. But A lot more big bucks. Some of those Ohio bucks are comparable.
Oh yeah. Well, we're even bigger for sure. So, back to your mule deer hunt that's coming up. How do you scout out? I know nothing about mule deer other than most of the hunts that I see for them are a spot and stalk. Is that how you're going to do that?
No, my hunt's going to be a little bit different because it's going to be mostly wooded. So essentially my hunt is going to be a lot of kind of ambush hunting, setting up on trails that I think they're going to take from feeding down in the valleys to higher up bedding locations. And I'm anticipating it's probably going to be mostly a morning thing and an afternoon thing. Because we're going back to the same unit, probably the same trailhead, and all of us saw a lot of mule deer last year, more so than elk. And I think the success rate is also probably around 30% or so for archery mule deer.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
So when you go into that, did you see any big muleys last year?
I didn't, but my buddy saw a nice 5x5, and I know a couple of my other friends that have been there in the past, one of them shot like a 183 or a 185. Ooh. And sent me a picture of one of his other buddies who shot a big one. I mean, there's big deer. There's just, it's hard to find them sometimes because, like I said, it's mostly wooded there. So it's not like you can just glass them up from, half mile away.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you'll go in and you'll hike in your stand and hang it. Will you leave it and then come back to it, or will you take it in and out with you?
No, I won't use a stand out there.
Oh, you're not?
We'll backpack in a few miles, get to our, kind of base campsite, and just hunt from the ground from there.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. And then the way I would understand it, then you're just going to use the natural cover to...
Yep, pretty much.
Keep you... Yeah, sort of like an elk hunt then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What time of the year are you leaving to do that?
We're going to be out there from, let's see, it's I think the 9th through the 16th. We probably won't hunt all those days. We'll probably cut it off at like the 14th or 15th or something.
Yeah. So you're no elk in the plans this year?
No, but I mean the other guys all have elk tags, so
oh, they
probably
do.
Be doing, especially if I tag out early, I'll be helping them with calling and filming and whatnot.
Oh, so it's right around the corner for you then.
You're
getting ready to go. So
that'll be a cool trip. How many guys go? How many guys do you hunt with?
It'll be four this year.
Yeah, that'll be fun. That's again, I'm kind of jealous. Someday we're talking about that here in the near future, maybe next year.
Not maybe next year.
Next year. Along with that Colorado trip, then how many states do you hunt for whitetail in?
It's really just Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Yeah. Well, that's enough. That'll keep you busy all hunting.
Two states is enough.
Yeah,
that's for sure. Unless you have no other obligations. I mean,
right? Yeah. Well, the thing is, too, it's like if I'm solely looking to fill the freezer, then it's no issue between those two states because there's plenty of deer, depending on where you're at in the state, obviously. But then the other thing is if you're looking to take like a mature buck, it's like, yeah, I could go down to Iowa to a place where I don't have nearly as much experience with. I haven't scouted it as much. I'm going mostly based off of, you know, aerial maps and just kind of banking on the fact that there are more big deer around.
Yeah.
Or I can stay back in the states that I know well. I know the swamps and, you know, the woods like the back of my hands. I know where the bigger deer like to hang out, and I get an advantage that way, even though there's fewer bigger deer around. It's easier to get on them.
Well, Wisconsin's a big buck state, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you guys kill some big bucks out there. A lot more than I think here. Well, I think it's right up there.
Yeah.
As far as booners go.
Well, you get outside of Pennsylvania, anything's a big buck state.
No, that's not true. Now, Pennsylvania, you know, we're seeing some good bucks this year.
Yeah, there's every year it gets better and better.
Yeah. But
so if you have a choice on your bow hunting, are you a traditional guy or do you take that compound? Because I know I've watched your traditional videos and the bow build and trying to kill deer with that. So typically, what are you taking into the woods with you?
I mean, right now it's a little bit of both. I'll be bringing my compound out to Colorado, but when I hunt deer around home, it's going to be 100% recurve.
100%.
Yeah, I mean, as far as shooting, like around the house and stuff, when I go out to the range, I probably shoot, I don't know, 70, 80 shots with the recurve for every one shot with the compound, just because it's so much, you know, it doesn't take as much to stay consistent with the compound once you kind of built the base.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoy shooting them both, and I'll probably start up even, you know, some competition next year, I think, with maybe both, but especially the traditional.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So with the traditional bow, what range are you practicing at?
I'll shoot out to about 40 yards for practicing, but I wouldn't shoot at a deer that far.
Right, sure. What kind of accuracy do you hold at 40 yards when you're practicing?
Right now, 40 yards, it's a good day. I could probably hold it in, I mean, a pie plate for sure.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yeah.
I know guys that shoot compounds that can't do that. Well, it's true, right?
I mean, once I started kind of really digging in deep into the technical aspect of it and studying, you know, the NTS, you know, kind of the target archery form and drilling myself on that and trying just about everything under the sun in terms of anchor points and three under versus split finger versus string walking and just kind of experimenting to the point of where I finally found something that really works. And then continuing to work on it some more, it really made a huge difference in my accuracy.
So what brought on that passion? Because, I mean, I learned how to shoot that way.
Me too. And I won't go back.
My shooting progressed from that recurve to a compound bow that didn't have sights on it. So you're basically, you know, you're gauging your shot the same way to, you know, today's compound bows where, you know, everything's on them. So what brought the passion for the traditional?
I think the kind of the inspiration was just kind of primitive archery at first. I'd wanted to, you know, try shooting a primitive bow for a while. I never really, you know, had the means to build one. I tried building one in college and it didn't work out. So then I kind of took a step back and made that laminated bow that I have the YouTube video on.
Yeah.
And then that was actually, you know, probably the first traditional bow that I had shot. I hadn't really shot anything at like a, you know, a traditional archery shoot or a bow shop or anything. So that was kind of my first real experience shooting one was with the one that I had made. And now that I've gotten more exposure into it, I've shot a few different kinds of bows. And now the recurve that I'm shooting right now has, you know, an aluminum riser and and whatnot. But yeah, it's that's kind of what started it for me.
Do you still hunt with that homemade bow?
I did last year. This year I might not do it as much. We'll see.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty low on arrows for that one right now because I have different arrow setups for all my different bows.
And those,
so I have plenty of arrows for my new one right now.
Those arrows for the homemade bow were those. You also made those, right?
I have made some. I've made some flu ones out of wood.
Yeah.
The ones that I hunted with were carbon.
Okay.
But I'm kind of thinking that what I might do in the future is for any, you know, either that bow or any additional wood bows that I make, I'll probably just shoot, you know, wood or bamboo arrows with them.
Yeah.
Do you shoot that bow instinctively or does it have sights on it?
There's no sights, but I do use an aiming method of sorts.
Okay.
And that's kind of a whole can of worms in and of itself, but I kind of use the tip of the arrow subconsciously. I know where it's at in my sight picture and the gap between where that blurry tip of the arrow is and, you know, the spot on the target that I want to hit. That's kind of how my brain sets up the shot and know when to release.
That's pretty impressive. I, you know, when I shot it, we had brass pins that were, I mean, huge.
Oh, I never had pins. When I learned, it was all instinctive. I mean, but I didn't go to the, I just didn't shoot it enough to go to the level that he's on there either. But okay. I was decent. I mean, I could hit decent out to 25 yards, but I was young too. I was just a kid. And then I carried that into maybe my early teens. And then compound bows just weren't a big thing then when I was a kid. We're talking,
well, you're
we're going back
dirt.
Into the,
I mean, there's dirt and then there's steel.
We're going back into the late 70s, early 80s now.
When you started shooting?
Yeah. I'm 44 years old.
Well, you are old. So, how many deer have you taken with those bows?
None yet.
No. So does it ever make?
I built my first longbow in, you know, not the last spring, but the one before, and I hunted with it pretty limited that first year just because I wasn't proficient with it enough yet.
Sure.
And then last year I hunted pretty much all year with it, and I missed one doe. But then I had shot three deer in the metro hunt with my compound, and there just wasn't really, even though I would have late season hunted with that bow, I just really didn't have a whole lot of drive to get back out there and put even more meat in the freezer. But this year, it's going to happen.
You're going to make it happen, huh?
I'm going to make it happen.
You had that. I watched that. You had that miss on video on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
It was, do you think if that deer doesn't duck that string, or that deer moved a lot on you, though, that arrow to me
looked
like.
Yeah, but the arrow still went under it.
Yeah, it did.
I shot low, and that arrow was, I don't think I've ever chronographed it, but I was shooting a 700 grain arrow out of about a 60-pound bow. So
130.
It's moving. It's probably moving 140, 150 feet per second.
How far away was that deer? Like, it was in a 20-yard range somewhere around there.
Yeah, right? I think it was probably like 23 yards or so. And I aimed for about 20.
Oh, that
at
was
that arrow speed. If you're off even by a little bit, and you know, it was cold, so. Yeah. My draw length is, you know, a half inch shorter than it would normally be.
Yeah.
That combined. Yeah, it can make a big difference.
You didn't miss it by much, though. I thought for sure when I was watching that video, I was going to watch you kill one. And then at the end, I was like, oh,
you know,
man.
Though, props for you for putting it on there, that miss. I think that's really cool because I think.
It's a really cool video.
Too many times people sensationalize
yeah.
the hunt. And to me, I want to see the real deal. I don't want to see like every kill shot. I'm not saying I could care less about seeing a kill shot, but I'm saying I want to see it real. You know, if you're going to miss, I want to see it.
Yeah.
I want to see you miss. Because that's what normal people.
Yeah. That what's cool about it is when you see a video like that, you relate to him so well because it's happened to everybody.
There you go, Garrett. You're very relatable. So, what does your whitetail season look like this year? Tell me quickly. Not quickly. You can take as long as you want. I shouldn't have said it that way. How do you get on the animals in your area?
So, for me, the style that I kind of do is very heavily dependent on some of the strategies that like Dan Infault will preach.
Sure.
Hunting bedding areas and that type of thing.
Yep.
So in February, March, even April, I'm spending a lot of time in the woods just putting miles on. Mm-hmm. We got a couple pretty big marshes in my area, you know, like 10,000 acre plus marshes. And then the stuff that I hunt in Wisconsin is more hill country, bluff country, that type of thing. Yeah. And then when I hunt up by Duluth, it's more big woods, but we hunt on smaller tracks up there. So for the marshes in particular, I spend almost all my scouting just in those spring, late winter months. And then I don't really do a whole lot in the summer. Don't really do a whole lot in the early fall. Just kind of pick my spots based on wind position. I really don't go into the woods until the day that I actually hunt.
Wow, that's discipline. So you don't even do like a speed scouting trip or anything like that?
It probably wouldn't hurt every now and then, but part of the issue is some of my better spots to hunt are like an hour and a half drive.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, that's tough to do.
Just taking a quick scouting trip, you know, if it's during the week, by the time I get there, a lot of times it's almost dark already, and that could be, you know, the deer are on their feet.
Yeah.
So I don't want to screw it up and... Yeah, it ends up becoming a little bit of a weekend warrior type deal.
10,000 acres of marshland, that's a big chunk of marshland.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and I don't hunt any marsh.
Well, we don't have a lot around here.
No, I mean, we're pretty high up. But from what I understand, if you can find a dry spot in a marsh, you're in pretty good shape. Is that correct, Garrett?
Dry spots, so there'd be like islands sometimes where you get big pockets of trees right. that are surrounded by cattails and water. Mm-hmm. Those can be good places to look. Anytime where you have kind of your hardwoods that make a point out into the marsh, those can be good places. Sometimes just pockets of brush, you get like that red willow brush or whatever, that can be good, a really good spot, even if it's even if there's no trees around, which makes it pretty hard to hunt.
So you had talked about driving an hour and 15 minutes to hunt. I do that to fish quite a bit. I'll drive that far to fish. Well, in the spring, I'll do it two or three times a week sometimes. And I'm okay with that. Now, I understand that you're a pretty big fisherman yourself. I saw some of the photos that you had on there. That you're catching some big stuff out there. Is that all warm water stuff?
Meaning like open water as opposed to ice fishing?
Yeah, or even trout fishing, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I don't do a whole lot of trout fishing.
Yeah.
I've probably caught more lake trout than I have any other kind of trout combined, and I can probably count all the lake trout that I've caught on both my hands.
Oh, really? Yeah. So you guys don't have streams out there that hold trout very well?
We do. There's especially some up on the north shore of Lake Superior, and I've caught a couple trout there on a camping trip, and there's some good streams down in the southeastern part of the state, but I've just never really had anybody that's gotten me into it, and I haven't really seeked it out on my own.
Sure.
So most of the fishing I've done has been for, you know, walleyes and bass and pike.
Yeah, some of those bass I saw you holding up, those were smallmouth, I think. They were huge. I mean, How big were those?
If it's a picture I'm thinking of, I think one of them was just like a tenth of a pound shy of 5 pounds, like 4.9.
As a smallie, that is a monster.
I caught one that big in my life, but we were in Canada to do it, so.
So was they've that got on...
some big ones up here. They have tournaments. They'll do tournaments in the spring when the fish are on the beds. And, I mean, sometimes you'll get guys that come in with 5-plus-pound averages, left, you know, 6, even 7-pound fish that they'll bring into the weigh-in.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That is crazy. So how do you target those fish?
If they're on the bed, you can see them usually.
Sure.
But if it's like a, you know, July, August, it's a lot of looking at the maps, finding the weed lines, finding the rock piles, and just kind of, you know, covering water and just pounding it with tubes and deep water jigs and whatnot and drop shots just to try and find a pattern. You might find a pattern where you're catching a lot of little fish, but sometimes those big fish patterns can be hard to find. But if you can get on them, you can usually do pretty well in like a tournament atmosphere.
Do you get into any of the tournaments?
Yeah, I fish usually a couple bass tournaments every year with my buddy who's a lot more into it than me. He's actually switching his job, and he's going to get a job as a school teacher just so he can have his summers off to bass fish.
No kidding. That's one way to do it.
It is, man.
You do a lot of ice fishing too, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mainly catching when you're doing that? You still walleye fishing for that?
Yeah, for the most part. I'll usually fish some panfish too, especially crappies. We got a couple lakes pretty close to my house that I can go pretty regularly and catch a meal or two of crappies. So I'll do that kind of during the week after work. And usually the walleye trips will be kind of the bigger trips of the year. Go up to like Lake of the Woods or, you know, Red Lake, Rainy Lake, that type of thing.
So which is your favorite to eat?
I'd say it's a toss-up probably between crappies and walleyes for me. Perch are good too, bluegills. I don't know. It's hard to pick one. Walleyes are nice just because if you can get a couple, you know, 15-inch walleyes, you're done cleaning in no time. Whereas if you got panfish, you're sitting there for quite a while.
Nobody around here would even think about eating a bluegill.
Not too much.
That's crazy, isn't it? The cultural differences just between here and there. People catch some. I mean, we have some pretty big bluegills here too, right?
Yeah.
And nobody keeps those and eats them.
No, we always throw them back.
I'm saying let's eat them.
I know what you're saying.
Well, they taste great. The challenge is there's always kind of a debate about, you know, what size is the right size to keep bluegill so you don't fish a lake out and that type of thing.
So what do you think?
I don't know. I'm probably not the best equipped person to answer it, but usually if I keep a bluegill, it's between, you know, 7.5 and, you know, 8¾ inches. Usually if it's 9 or above, I'll throw it back. And if it's smaller than that, it's not worth cleaning generally unless you eat the whole fish. And I've really started doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I wouldn't mind doing that. I mean, we got some ponds around here. They're going to come back. You keep some bluegills, we could eat some. Have a fry.
The few ponds I'm thinking about, those fish are well over 9 inches, some of them.
Yeah.
The majority of them.
That's what I'm saying. And nobody does it around here. Nobody wants to eat bluegills. What's wrong with a bluegill?
I have no idea. I never ate one.
How many bluegills have you caught in your life? A ton.
Yeah.
And you've never eaten a bluegill?
Nope, never tried one.
That's a shame, isn't it, Garrett?
Yeah. You're missing out.
You are missing out.
Well, we'll have to try a few.
Let's do that.
All right.
So, if you were to choose also, I'm putting you to the test here, hunting or fishing, what is it?
For me, it'd probably be hunting.
Yeah?
I'd say if you asked me when I was growing up, I would have said fishing. I think it's kind of switched now. I still enjoy both. It's hard to pick between one of the two, but definitely more of my time is spent toward hunting.
Do you think it's because of the challenge?
That's probably part of it.
Yeah. Because hunting is certainly a tougher than fishing. I mean, fishing is, I'm not saying it's easy. I mean, but it can be easy. And hunting can...
Depends how you do it.
Yeah, but hunting can almost never be easy, right? I mean, you can luck into something, but consistently good is easier in the fishing world than it is in
the hunting world. There's a lot more work involved on the hunting end of it, I think, than the fishing end, as far as if you're a serious bow hunter, it's almost a 12-month a year commitment.
I'm telling you what, this week I was thinking about it. I could spend our season open. Well, we're going to Ohio the last week of September, right?
Yeah.
I could spend every weekend between now and then and quite a few weeknights and still not be as ready as I want to be.
No, you're right. And then I'm even talking as far as right down to, you know, this time of year, my process has changed a little bit from, you know, working out maybe once or twice a week to trying to get back into, you know, running and working out again 4 or 5 days a week because, well, let's be honest, I'm not getting any younger and it's taxing when that time of the year comes and you don't have to do that to go fishing.
No, you're right.
I didn't have to ever do that to go hunting until, you know, probably 5 years ago. Yeah.
That's right.
I never considered myself out of shape, but, you know, when you hit your 40s, your body still wants to go, 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 but your mind says, hold up, buddy, we need to stop and take a couple breaths here. I don't want to, you know, and so, you know, so I try to avoid that come hunting season.
Oh, no, I hear you.
This time of year. But it's just like there's always something that you can be doing the whole year to prepare for hunting season, no matter if it's scouting or working out or hanging trail cams, there's always something you can be doing.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a never-ending cycle, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You get that break, well, not even always. I was thinking, like, January.
Well, we shoot, though, in January. We never put our bows down. That's another thing. Right. It just depends how committed you want to be to what you're doing, I guess.
Yeah.
Fishing could be the same commitment if you
want. Oh, trust me. When I was heavy into fly fishing, I was spending, I think the 1 year I spent close to 150 days on the water.
Yeah.
My wife wasn't happy.
No.
But
I don't imagine so.
But you know.
They know what we do and they love us in spite of it.
That's right. So Garrett, have you done anything to get ready for your trip out west? You're going to do a lot of hiking out there.
Yeah, I've been staying, for the most part, in shape pretty much year-round.
Yeah.
I've been pretty much active since, you know, since graduating college when I had access to all the nice weight rooms and stuff. Mm-hmm. Just probably for the last 6 months or so, I picked up CrossFit just because I needed something to kind of keep me going. I was losing the motivation.
Let's talk about that, Garrett. I want to talk about CrossFit. You know, okay. I've been working out for probably, well, I quit chewing eight or nine years ago, and I've been working out ever since. And I've done lots of programs, and I'm pretty consistent. I keep myself in pretty good shape. The only thing I haven't done is CrossFit because I feel like I might not have the right equipment for it. What do you think about CrossFit?
I like it. I mean, it's great physical prep, and at least when you have like the type of coaches that are at the gym that I go to, because that can make a big difference if it's a guy that, you know, just got his coaching certification over the weekend, or if it's a guy that, you know, is a genuinely good coach and has spent his life, you know, kind of perfecting his craft. But you can kind of just go into it for, you know, just the general physical prep, or if you want to take it to the extreme, you can either go and pursue like a CrossFit competition, which is mm-hmm. quite a bit more rigorous, or you can even split off and find like an Olympic lifting coach and get more into that. There's a little bit of leeway in terms of what you want to do and what's available.
So the way I understand it, I don't know enough about it. Other than I think there's a workout of the day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's nationwide?
No, usually they'll have one posted, I think, on their website. That's kind of like a nationwide thing. But I know, like, the gym that I go to, they'll write their own workout of the days. And so then anybody who's taken that class on that day will do that workout of the day. But they also then have other workouts for, like, barbell club, where if you don't want to do the CrossFit workout, you can do the barbell club workout, which is basically like a powerlifting slash Olympic lifting workout.
And so this workout of the day, so how many times a day, how many times a week do you typically do CrossFit?
I usually go 3 times a week.
And you, that's enough, right? I mean, CrossFit's pretty tough.
Yeah. Yeah, that, it can be, especially if you're pushing yourself. If you, you know, kind of go half-assed, then yeah, you can make it as easy as you want. But man, if you're actually pushing yourself, it gets pretty tough. Even though the workouts are short.
Is that a half an hour a day? Is that 45 minutes? What is that?
Well, if I'm doing a barbell workout, it'll be there 2.5 hours. But if I'm doing just like the normal CrossFit WOD workout of the day,
yep,
usually it ends up being roughly 45 minutes to an hour when it's all said and done, because first you start with a warm up and, you know, you go over what the workout's going to be, how to do the various exercises, then you do the workout, which is usually somewhere between 8 and 20 minutes depending on what that particular workout is, and then you'll usually do some core work or stretching or whatnot afterwards and cool down.
I'm intrigued by it, but I also am a little worried too. How long did you say you've been doing that?
Like 6 months or so. But I mean, even before that, even, you know, all the way down to high school, I've been doing, you know, squats and deadlifts and cleans and all that good stuff.
Right.
I'll say this, that like at the gym that I go to, there's people of all shapes and sizes. You got people that are in super great shape, and you've got, you know, people that are in their 50s still doing it. You got people that are overweight and trying to drop weight. It's really something that just about anybody can do. I would say that if you're worried about whether or not you're physically able to do a workout, they can scale it down. That shouldn't be a reason that you should stay away from it.
Well, I'm certainly not worried about that. But what I would be worried about is injuries, because that's pretty that's really strenuous.
Mm-hmm. So really the only two main ways you're going to get injured doing like CrossFit is if you do something technically incorrect, which a good coach should be able to help prevent you from getting into that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're, you know, kind of overreaching, overtraining, which the only time I've really seen that happen is for the people that are, you know, training for like the competition where they're there 5 days a week and they're doing the WODs plus other stuff on the side. And
those people,
it's just a high workload. Look at any sport, any high level sport.
Yeah.
People get injured no matter how careful they are, how good their form is.
Yeah.
Just because they're pushing what the body's capable of.
Maybe this winter we'll have to try it.
I try it. I've been doing these different programs for a long time, and I enjoy it. I enjoy the process. I enjoy the workout.
I enjoy it once I get there. My problem is getting there. Like, I have to really make myself do it. But once I'm doing it,
you enjoy it afterwards, and I feel great. Yeah.
It's getting there for me. It's getting to the point of getting started.
Mm-hmm. And the discipline of sticking with it.
It takes a lot of discipline, for sure. Yeah. It's almost as much discipline as an all day tree stand sit.
Whew. I don't know, man. Steve and I sat last year for, what was it, 7 days?
6 or 7 days every day.
Non-stop, every day, dusk till dawn.
And people wouldn't think
the other way around.
Yeah. You wouldn't think you'd get so wore out after 6 days of sitting around, but man, it took me a couple of days to recover after that week.
Well, we would.
That's draining.
Yeah.
Yeah. We would get back to our cabin that we were renting, and, you know, Steve and I like to enjoy a couple beers every now and then. There was none of that going. There was like one beer and we were out.
We ate, sat down, and if you sat down too long, you ended up sleeping where you were sitting. You had to go to bed. It was it wears you out.
It was pretty intense. So do you do all day sits, Garrett?
Only during the rut.
Yeah.
That's where we were coming on to. We typically don't do them till then. And that first one, you know, a year later, that first one's just brutal. Because you do get used to it after a while. It's not so bad. And that first one I sat this year, it was a little early, I think. Deer weren't up on their feet like we had predicted they were going to be. I sat all day.
Here.
Yeah. And I saw one deer.
Yeah. Oh, and that is brutal. Oh, only seeing one deer the whole day, knowing that you didn't really need to be there.
Well, by the time, you know, lunchtime gets here, you're thinking, well, now I have to stay because there's no point getting down now for the next 5 hours because, well, we've had success midday sometimes too. So
yeah,
once you put that morning in and you get to lunchtime, you're there. There's no leaving and coming back. If you leave, you might as well just stay at home.
You can relocate, but you better do it before that midday move that the bucks make.
But Cody and I are kind of on opposite ends of the scale there. I'll tend to stick it out and stay even if I only see one deer. If he doesn't see a deer in a couple hours, he's bouncing around sometimes. Well, I was just going to ask Garrett what his normal approach was there.
Yeah, what is your approach, Garrett?
It depends on what I'm seeing. Like if, for example, there was a, you know, I think 2011, I shot a buck after six all day sits, but I did quite a bit of moving prior to actually getting in the spot where I shot that deer because it was a new area to me. So I would sit on a spot that there was deer sign and I would see one deer move through the woods 100 yards away. And then an hour later, I'd see another deer move through, you know, and then I would move my stand, get there, you know, for the remainder of the day and maybe see one more deer. And then I just kind of kept doing that, kept moving on to where the deer were actually showing up. And then eventually I ended up shooting one. But I would say typically, unless I see a reason to move, I'll usually stay put.
Yeah, that's, I think I do that too often sometimes. What about on a wind shift?
Yeah, wind shift, I'll move too, depending on how much daylight's left. If I don't have enough daylight to move, then I'll just stick it out. But
sure.
Yeah, sometimes on a wind shift where we're sitting, you have to completely leave the area too. So,
right.
And sometimes it might just be a swirl. You have to actually know if it's, you know, you might start getting down and all of a sudden the wind goes back to the way it was.
Yeah. We have a lot of swirling winds here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It can be deceiving, that's for sure.
It can be frustrating too.
Yeah, but that's part of the game.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean, so, if you're not going to be willing to sit there all day, that's part of the game too. But it doesn't make it any easier sometimes.
Those all-day sits, man, you can be in as good a shape as you want. You're still going to hurt at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, last year I was in phenomenal shape.
Yeah, you're right. So we have the DIY sportsman here. Do you have any mods for making yourself comfortable in those all-day sit situations?
Caffeine?
That helps.
Usually the biggest mental challenge for me is I spread out my food throughout the day.
Yeah.
I'd be like, well, I know I can't eat this. If I want to eat this this protein bar at, you know, 10 a.m. and then I got another one at 3 p.m.
Yeah.
And then it gets to like 9:15. I'm like, man, I'm hungry. Then, you know, I usually make it to like 9:45, and then it gets to like the second one, and it's like 1 o'clock.
That's what happens. Hours. You know what the bad part about food for me is? It gives you something to do when you're bored. So I always end up being like, well, maybe I should eat now. And then next thing you know, you're out of food, and you're twice as bored. And we sat one time last year, and when we hunt Ohio, we stay in a cabin, and then we drive about 40 minutes away to where we're hunting at. So we drive out. I get out there, and I start putting my pack together, and I look, and I forgot my lunch. I packed it, but it was at the cabin yet, and we're planning on an all-day sit, and I'm like, oh, my – and I was devastated. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, we're going to sit here till – I probably won't get out of the stand till like 5:30, 6 o'clock, and I have nothing to eat for like 12 hours. So I'm like, I'll be all right. I'm just going to man up and do it. I went, I had like 2 bottles of water. That's all I have to consume for this whole time. At noon, my buddy Cody texts me. He's like, it's pretty warm out today. I don't know if I should eat this sandwich. He said, I'm not sure if it's any good or not. Well, by this time, I'm like, oh, I'm trying not to think about it, right? The whole time, I'm trying not to think about having any food. I text him back. I'm like, I'll walk over and get it right now because I'll eat every single bite of it. We got back that night. And I ate almost everything. I think I ate the lunch I packed, and we made supper. I ate half of it, and then I passed out in bed and slept till the next morning. I was never so hungry in my life when I got back after that day.
Well, and that can wear you out, too, if you're hungry, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, then you're just mentally just
fighting. I'm surprised you didn't send me a selfie with you biting into the sandwich. That would have put the icing on the cake.
I should have. That's what I should have done.
But yeah, you talk about an all day sitting and you talk about not having any food for it. That just makes, oh man, brutal. Yeah.
All day
sitting. Or if you're cold.
Yeah, I had my buddy
drop me off. So I literally had no vehicle that I could go back to. He just dropped me off on the side of the road and I just trucked, you know, 3/4 of a mile through a Northwood swamp. And I got water in my boot and it was probably 20 degrees, which. You know, normally 20 degrees is bearable, but
yeah,
when you got a wet boot, oh, it was miserable. It was noon. I was down at the base of the tree doing bodyweight squats and push-ups, knowing that he wasn't going to come until dark.
I'll tell you, when that cold sets into your core like that, too, there's not much you can do to get yourself warm. I mean, you can do jumping jacks and, like you said, core squats and stuff like that. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. It's tough, man. Those all day sits are just brutal. There's
no
way.
But they're really fun when you look back on them. Yeah. You know,
you kind of look forward to it.
You do, yeah. In a way.
But then again, you're like, whew.
I'll tell you what. I was so hoping after you sent me the text about the sandwich that I was gonna make a kill that afternoon or that evening because I was gonna send you a text and I'd be like, I'm frying steaks now. How's that sandwich taste?
Well, Garrett, thanks for joining us. This has been fun. We really enjoy what you got going on over there, man. I love your ingenuity.
Me too. Keep putting them out. We're going to keep watching them because they're cool.
I'm an engineer also, and always looking to improve my gear, always looking to, you know, be more comfortable, be more efficient, things like that. So all really good stuff. If you want to find Garrett, you can go to DIY-sportsman.com or you can look on his YouTube channel.
Yeah, just search DIY Sportsman and I think his playlist comes up.
Yeah.
I don't, how many videos do you have on there now, Garrett?
I think about 100 now.
Whoo, man, 100. That's a lot. You know, and we could keep talking because there's lots of questions I'd like to ask.
Oh, there's
you.
Tons of stuff on there we haven't even touched on.
Yeah. But Steve S. get up at 4 a.m. So thanks for joining us. We're looking forward.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh yeah, we're looking forward to seeing more from you.
Yeah, we'll be keeping an eye on you there. Let us know. You have our number too. Let us know how you're doing this season. We'd be really interested in that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, okay, everybody. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time. So this week we're trying to do something new. We talked about it, and we skipped a week.
Oh, we're not trying. We're doing it.
We're doing it. Right, yeah. So we skipped a week, though.
We did it a week later, and we said we were going to.
Right.
Here we go. This is it.
So this week, we're doing a, instead of our favorite beers, which, you know, we could continue to go on forever, but they'd be just lists of IPAs. And I know that not everybody just drinks IPAs. So we've decided to
review a few beers.
Right. Broaden our horizons a little bit.
A lot of guys on their podcast review gear, clothing.
Yep.
We're going to review beer. Right. Not to say we're not going to review gear and clothing later. Yeah. But
I think the next episode we'll probably touch on a little bit of gear and clothing. Yeah.
But let's review a beer for now.
Okay. Let's do that. So Steve stopped at the local six-pack on the way here. and he picked up a Pacific Wonderland.
Okay.
Lager.
Yeah, and the idea of this is to try to get away from our IPAs a little bit. I'm not sure why we're doing that, but we decided.
Because not everybody drinks IPAs, and we want to hear, I'm sure they want to hear about other things. Plus, it allows us to broaden our horizons. It's not that we haven't drank a ton of lagers in the past, but.
Yeah. Yingling.
Well, hey, it's hard to beat a Yingling lager.
It is local.
Yep. Oldest brewery in America. Active brewery, I think. So
I picked up a lager.
Yeah, it's made by Deschutes. It's 5.5% alcohol, and it's a 50 IBU. Is that right?
40.
A 40 IBU. So it's not on the same scale as your typical IPA.
Not even close.
But it is very similar on this scale for a pale ale, right?
Yeah, that's what it tastes like.
So for all you guys out there who are wondering, what's the difference, right? The difference between a lager and a pale ale is, one, the yeast, and two, the fermentation temperature. A lager needs to be fermented between, all right, don't get mad at me, beer geeks, but I think it's between 40 and 50 degrees. I did one time. I put a temperature controller on my kegerator, and I fermented it in the kegerator, and it turned out pretty good. I was actually quite impressed with how it turned out. At any rate, this beer. So we're looking at a lager that they must have used an ale malt, right? Because it's really light.
It's almost looks like a cloudy Coors Light or Bud Light or something like that.
Right.
But it is a little bit cloudy. So it must not have got filtered completely, or they left it that way on purpose. It's good. I said it was refreshing. It's pretty warm here today, and
it's, you do get that. Beer. You still get the lager taste a little bit. But it's certainly more on a pale ale scale as far as hoppiness, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the, you know how pale ales have that, like, it's like a clean?
Like, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, and if you're not into the huge hop bitterness, this is a good one because it's not there. It's not. Well, you can.
It would be for somebody who has never had any hop
bitterness. Maybe.
Don't you think?
40 IBUs is getting pretty low. But, yeah, you could probably taste it a little bit.
I actually
think my wife would drink that beer.
I like it.
She doesn't like hops.
No.
A lot of hops.
Yeah. She makes that face and then scrapes her tongue.
Yeah.
I like it. I'd drink it again.
I would, too. Yeah, it's for sure. It's good.
Be good all day, or because it's only 5.5%.
Yeah, I don't do all dayers anymore.
Me neither. Didn't you say you go broke drinking old dares?
No, I said with this stuff you would.
Oh yeah.
So price point, it's
okay. That makes I know.
It's probably about between $11 and $12 a six pack. So
yeah, for you guys out there, they're like, you're crazy. Well, in this instance,
you sit down and have one or two,
yeah,
and then the next time you go back to it, you have one or two, so that
you're not drinking it all day long.
You stretch that out.
Right.
So if you're going to drink all day, you need to cheapen it up a little bit. That's not what we're trying to do. We're doing this for
flavor. Taste.
We're not doing it for...
That's right. It's not to get drunk.
No.
So that's our beer for the day. This podcast was brought to you by Cody and Steve.
That's awesome.
Yep. And it'll continue to be that way for a while.
Yes, sir.
And we look forward to, I think next episode, we're just going to maybe just have you and I without a guest. And that'll be the first time in a long time.
It will. It'll be fun, though. We've been pretty busy. So
yeah,
we're with jobs and trying to wrap stuff up and scouting and shooting and hanging cameras and running to concerts, and it's crazy.
Yeah, it'll be a big BS session, I think.
It'll be good.
All right. So tune in next week, and thanks for listening, everybody.
Good night.